From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. We're broadcasting this week from my hometown, Monroe, Louisiana. We're on KMLB in their studio, and we're glad you're with us.
Money in politics has always been greasy and corrupting and horrible and also boring. This year, it got significantly more horrible and slightly less boring.
That's MSNBC host Rachel Maddow speaking at the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards in New York City. Rachel, along with the Reverend Dr. Joan Brown Campbell, received the award last Sunday from Interfaith Alliance. We'll bring you some of the insightful and inspiring words that these women spoke during the ceremony.
He bowed to her and said, "Allahu Akbar." Margaret's hand went to her heart, or so it appeared. Malcolm knew what she was really reaching for. Under her dress, inside a homespun bag that she wore on a cord around her neck, were the pages her father had given to her before he died, pages from an ancient book written in the language of the prophet. "Allahu Akbar," Margaret agreed, and she added significantly that God was also merciful.
Mary Helen Stefaniak is the author of a fascinating new novel, The Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia. State of Belief Radio spoke to her about the vision for an appreciation of the differences among us that's woven throughout this story of becoming a community in the 1930s.
There's no correlation between inacceptance of homosexuality and depression and suicide.
Oh, my goodness. Claiming credibility based in part on religious credentials, Tony Perkins, president of the ironically named Family Research Council, weighed in this week on the tragedy of LGBT youth suicides and anti-gay bullying. We'll weigh in on the shocking claim he made on National Public Radio. Election day is just a couple of days away now, and most folks concerned with religious liberty and the separation of church and state are frankly holding our collective breath. It's not about which party is in power when the votes are counted. It's about the tactics used to get into office and the intentions of individual candidates once they're in office. And this year's campaigning has been marked by relentless use, in fact, one can say abuse, of religious faith on a number of fronts. Let me ask you something. When you talk politics at the dinner table, and I hope you do, which of these tactics works to draw your attention as you decide on how to cast your vote? The smearing of opponents' religious convictions or lack thereof? Positions on the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in a religious context? Positions on anti-gay bullying and violence in a religious context, positions on gay marriage, a woman's right to choose, the teaching of creationism in public schools in a religious context, or the wholesale misrepresentation of the United States Constitution in regards to the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, the feeding of fear and hostility of and toward Muslim Americans, their right to freely build houses of worship, and challenging the legitimacy of the Muslim faith in the courts. For some historical context, take a minute to listen to Dr. Saeed M. Saeed, the National Director for the Office of Interfaith and Community Alliances for the Islamic Society of North America. Saeed received the Interfaith Alliance President's Award in New York last Sunday, and he spoke about the environment in which Islam matured in this country.
Islam in America is actually an interfaith alliance in the sense that today we have 2,000 to 3,000 Islamic centers from California to New York Island. And majority of them, 97% of them, were built during my lifetime. So before, we didn't have that many centers. It was the American churches that opened their doors for us to organize our Islamic activities, rituals, and meetings, and so on. And it continues. I have led Friday prayer, our weekly mass, for 10 years in a church in Washington, D.C., and this is going on from city to city in America. Many of these centers were built with total consensus, with total support and encouragement by the local churches and synagogues.
That's right. You heard that correctly. There was a time when churches in America, instead of encouraging divisiveness and fear, helped bring people of different faiths together by inviting Muslims to gather within their walls. There's so many places in our country where this would be unthinkable today. I would suggest that these and many other issues are vulnerable to being filtered through a series of competing religious tests, and that the only logical outcome would be the total paralysis of our secular system of government. State of Belief radio listeners are likely to agree with the fundamental position that political decisions are to be made in a political context while always ensuring freedom of religious belief, practice, and discussion among all people. It is this framework that has been so badly eroded during this election cycle. And so perhaps it would be best to step away from the individual arguments, provocative claims, and angry rhetoric, to step just far enough away to see clearly what's happening, and then make Election Day decisions based on protecting that framework. If you're old enough to remember the presidential election of 1960, you will remember the noisy claims that John F. Kennedy, if elected, would take his orders from the Vatican. You'll also remember that the first Catholic president did no such thing. As the 2010 campaign season draws to a close, let us retain the right to believe as we choose, to support the causes we will, and to debate the issues that inspire passion in us. But in the voting booth, let's make decisions that will preserve those rights. A candidate whose positions you agree with, but who campaigns using the language of religiosity, is not a candidate that's good for American politics. A candidate you would happily support, who manipulates voters' religious fears or beliefs to win public office, is not a candidate that deserves your vote. Not for the Senate, not for Congress, not for town council, not for school board. In other words, let us preserve this most important of protections, and then, on November 3rd, resume, in the words of author Jeff Charlotte, the noise of democracy. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. Still ahead on this week's show, we'll take our microphones to the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards in New York City and hear from the recipients, Reverend Dr. Joan Brown Campbell and MSNBC host Rachel Maddow. And later, author Mary Helen Stefaniak talks about her inspiring new novel, The Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia. Be sure to stay tuned to State of Belief Radio. We're coming right back.
On the precipice of this election, though, it is time to start thinking very seriously about what we have learned from all of the other times that we have had to fight this. How did those battles shake out in the past? What was the breaking point when those extremists were no longer able to sustain public support for their positions? I mean it not in inspirational terms, but in very practical terms. We are now going to have to remember what we have learned from all the other times we have had this fight in this country.
Welcome back, everybody, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's MSNBC host Rachel Maddow speaking at this year's Faith and Freedom Awards ceremony given by Interfaith Alliance. More from Rachel in a minute, but first, I want to play some of what the other recipient, Reverend Dr. Joan Brown Campbell, had to say. Reverend Dr. Campbell has devoted many years to working on religious liberty. She's an ordained minister and a leader in the ecumenical interfaith movement. She's currently director of the Department of Religion at the Chautauqua Institution in upstate New York. Whether standing side by side with Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. or confronting Fidel Castro in Cuba, hers is a voice that deserves listening to.
Walter Cronkite and I were friends. More importantly, we shared a passionate belief in the power of faith. Both of us recognize that faith marked by love has liberating power. but faith rigidly constructed, exclusive in identity and membership, could destroy the freedom that is embedded in the First Amendment and the hallmark of our democracy. All of us here know how profoundly fragile is the precious gift of freedom. In 1994, the religious right, they were growing in influence. I was then General Secretary of the National Council of Churches, and I was a witness and often a target to the forces of Christian supremacism. The warning signals were there. The warning signals of faith turned judgmental, favoring one religion over all others, and it had to be confronted. It became clear that the only effective, honest, truthful, legitimate response to the Christian religious right was an interfaith response, a response that held as precious the variety of faiths that come together, that make up and are, in fact, the body politic in this country. So the Interfaith Alliance was born. And to this very day, it sets forth continually the value of religious freedom. As one who has been privileged to travel the world, I can tell you I believe it is our most precious freedom. We should remember this on November 2nd.
That's the Reverend Dr. Joan Brown Campbell speaking at last Sunday's Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards given by Interfaith Alliance. Sharing the honor and the stage was MSNBC host Rachel Maddow. As a brilliant broadcaster and analyst, Rachel raised the issue of separation of church and state on her very first program, and she continues to be an articulate and insightful spokesperson for this fundamental principle of American democracy.
In 9 days, we will test a hypothesis that I have about faith and freedom in America and what's going on in American politics right now. I mean, we will do a lot more besides test my hypothesis. We will choose a new Congress. We will choose new state legislatures, new governors. We will decide in the state of Colorado if fertilized eggs are secretly people. We will also test, though, whether or not culture wars are back. And culture wars mean, at their heart, an attack on the separation of church and state. The Beltway line is this year about how social issues are dead, how the new right is all about fiscal conservatism and small governance. But reality keeps messing with that dumb line. The closest thing that the right has to a team captain right now, Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina, he now says gay people should not be allowed to teach in America. 5 U.S. Senate candidates this year want abortion not only to be illegal, they would have the federal government intervene to force rape victims to bear the child that was the result of rape or of incest. The October surprise on the right is turning out to be an uprising to kill NPR and kill public broadcasting with the excuse of the Juan Williams incident. The candidate who may unseat the Senate Majority Leader says that Thomas Jefferson was misquoted on the separation between church and state, just as she has been misquoted many times. The Senate candidate from Delaware, God bless her, does not believe that the Establishment Clause is real. The conservative resurgence right now is not about deficit spending. If it were, all of these so-called fiscal conservatives would not want to add $700 billion more onto the deficit so that the richest people in the country could be taxed less now than they were when Bill Clinton was president. I think that the part of the reason that some of the races may be tightening right now is because people may be cottoning to the idea that it is not about fiscal discipline. What's happening right now, the most interesting thing happening right now in American politics, and I say interesting with a cringe, as in may you live in interesting times. What's happening is that the right is ratcheting down its grip on the Republican Party once again. The conservative movement has grabbed the Republican Party by the lapels when the Republican Party was a mess and leaderless and weak. And in that state of weakness, the conservative movement has asserted itself, and they are getting the Republican Party back in line. And the conservative movement has not changed very much. Conservative, right? I mean, if you liked Newt Gingrich railing against public broadcasting in the 90s, you will love Jim DeMint doing it this year. If you liked Henry Hyde peacock strutting against reproductive rights, you will love Ken Buck doing the same. The effort to assert that the Establishment Clause doesn't exist, that it's meaningless, that the Constitution and our country are divinely inspired, that America is a Christian nation, that our government should promote a specific brand of Christianity and persecute other religions and even other interpretations of Christianity. The idea that God anoints candidates for office in America and that religious doctrine justifies constitutional abominations. This is not new. Even if you are younger than me, by a lot, this is not new. This happens a lot. On the precipice of this election, though, it is time to start thinking very seriously about what we have learned from all of the other times that we have had to fight this.
Rachel Maddow, MSNBC television host and recipient of the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award for 2010, speaking at the awards ceremony in New York last Sunday. Well, there's lots more to come on this week's show, including why Tony Perkins is bad for America and bad for religion. But first, we'll talk to the Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia author Mary Helen Stefaniak about her book and the hope it offers for finding ways to celebrate our differences and diversity. This is State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back, everybody. This is State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. A few weeks ago, I read the novel The Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia. It's a novel by Mary Helen Stefaniak. Immediately, I knew that I wanted to have the author on State of Belief Radio because there is a hopefulness in that narrative, a message of peace, a calming kind of emphasis that is rare in contemporary writing, and because there's a message that's very relevant to some of the divisiveness that we're seeing in our fragmented world today. Mary Helen's first novel, The Turk and My Mother, received the 2005 John Gardner Fiction Book Award, is currently teaching at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska. Published by W.W. Norton & Company, The Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia was selected the Independent Bookseller's Indie Next pick for September 2010, and I am absolutely delighted that it brings the author, Mary Helen Stefaniak, to State of Belief Radio today. Mary Helen, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
It would be helpful probably to our listeners if you would just very succinctly summarize the story so they have some idea of what's going on in the book.
Most of The Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia takes place in 1938-39, in one school year, when a well-traveled new school teacher comes to the tiny town of Three Steps, Georgia. And while Miss Spivey has her ardent supporters, she also riles some people up, some partly by her project of reviving the town festival, kind of defunct during the Depression, as an exotic Baghdad bazaar, complete with camels. People out find camels. She's well-traveled in the Middle East herself. She's kind of enamored of the Arabian Nights stories and that whole milieu. And actually, she also gets herself in maybe more troublesome than introducing this kind of somewhat foreign element to the tiny town of Three Steps is her involvement of black children as well as white in just putting together the Baghdad Bazaar, as she calls it. And in particular, there's a very talented 17-year-old African-American named Theo Boykin, who becomes kind of the architect of the Baghdad Bazaar. So I think we come to very much enjoy the 11-year-old narrator, Gladys Califf, who gives us the whole story, and whose brother Force is a pretty fascinating character, at least to Miss Spivey and to many others. So that's really kind of the gist of what happens in 1938-39. There is, following the Baghdad Bazaar, something terrible happens, and beset by tragedy, the people of Three Steps kind of gather for a night of storytelling while they're sort of waiting to see how things will turn out.
This whole book, the title and the story, struck me as a kind of classic double entendre. Everything about it has two meanings. The family name is what Muslim leaders are called. Baghdad is a place in Georgia, and it's a place in Iraq. The events in the story set in Georgia have counterparts in Muslim communities around the world. The school teacher in a small classroom does what teachers need to do around the world. Now, if you don't tell me I'm wrong, then I want to ask, were you conscious of what you were doing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And not very many people who've read the book have seen that, what I guess we could call it, the subtext or layer of story, you know, that's underneath the story that takes place in 1938-39. So I'm delighted that you see those parallels. I really started working on this in March of 2003. And it was after I'd read in the newspaper, you know, an account of the shock and awe bombing of Baghdad. And what I had in my mind was, I think I had this thought, something like, you know, we're bombing the cradle of civilization. And I just felt that I wanted to write a novel. Suddenly, I wanted to write a novel in which a group of Americans had a different sort of relationship to Baghdad, but kind of Baghdad in quotation marks, meaning the whole kind of broad swath of history and culture that that represents. And I just wanted readers to be able to experience this other kind of relationship where, where the whole of Baghdad had a different sort of connotation. And and then as time went on, it seemed particularly important to do that because of the sort of atmosphere of in subsequent years since 2003, you know, of intolerance.
Did you mention the word Islam in the book? I don't think you did.
Maybe not. Muslim, yes.
You did mention Muslim, but I don't think you mentioned Islam.
No, I didn't.
And yet, the strength of the subtext is that it is a perfect address to some of the kind of Islamophobia that we're experiencing right now in the nation. You, Mary Helen, wrote a good story that opened readers' minds to information that they didn't even know they were getting. And how did you think through that strategy?
Well, you know, mostly I just had this notion that I wanted to write a story that readers would experience a different kind of relationship to Islam, to Baghdad. I had this notion, I wrote a story full of characters that people would be interested in and would care about, and then put them in this situation, both in their own time, you know, 1938 is the time in Georgia when it was, you had a similar kind of intolerance, racial intolerance. I thought if that situation now, people would look back and feel this affection for the black characters and sympathy for the efforts of people to work together on this Baghdad Bazaar, and you know that they would that experience would transfer over into what they were learning about this Muslim connections as well.
And you know what's so important about the way you did it, at least from my perspective, is that you didn't beat anybody over the head with anything. You painted a picture of something that people wanted to enjoy. And so the whole matter of interracial relations or of interreligious suspicion and conflict, those were addressed without making anybody mad or getting them all hostile. It was by making them feel good and saying, you know, this is really fun. If you had your way, what do you want a reader to think after completing that book?
Well, you know, I kind of hope that they'll feel the many ways in which what happens in this book could be happening now as well. You know, mm-hmm. kind of the ways in which 1938 is 2010, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do know what you mean.
I offer the book to my readers. You know, if not as an antidote, at least as an alternative, as I grounded in history and imagination to the fearful and often hate-filled rhetoric that continues to bombard us. So it's an offering as an alternative and a way to experience this culture in a joy-filled way.
The new novel is called The Caliphs of Baghdad, Georgia. It's published by W.W. Norton and Company. I used to have a seminary professor who would say sometimes, if you got to sell your shirt to buy this book, you ought to buy it and read it. I would say that, especially if you've got another shirt in the closet. I've been talking to the author of that book, Mary Helen Stefaniak. And Mary Helen, I really thank you for being our guest.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Up next, great news from Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. In the case of dead LGBT youth versus homophobic bullying, Tony finds the defendant not guilty. Now, we're going to appeal that ruling. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. You don't want to miss this. This is State of Belief Radio. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. I'm quoting now. Since 1983, Family Research Council has advanced faith, family, and freedom in public policy and public opinion. End quote. That's the claim right on the FRC website. But in truth, the organization has injected itself into many important debates, most commonly on the side opposing individual liberties and resolutely defining family in exclusive and judgmental terms. Now, it should be no surprise that FRC President Tony Perkins drew this conclusion during a national public radio program this past week.
There's no correlation between in acceptance of homosexuality and depression and suicide.
Mr. Perkins, you may be a counsel, but I'm not seeing any research here. And if a bully helps drive a schoolmate to suicide, the untold suffering of the victim's family, and very likely the bully's family, requires little research. One experience every single one of us shares is that of adolescence. How much dishonesty does it take to pretend not to remember those experiences? Alienation, ridicule, physical and emotional abuse. When have these ever not had an impact on a young person?
These young people who do identify as gay or lesbian, we know from the social science that they do have a higher rate of depression and a propensity to suicide because of that internal conflict.
A recent study found that a high percentage of Americans form their views on homosexuality based at least in part on what they hear in their houses of worship. These views do affect the schoolyard, and the schoolyard does affect the young people whose lives are lived there. Mr. Perkins, the direction on this issue is clear. Americans are becoming more and more accepting of sexual minorities. It's only a matter of time before this particular issue is relegated to the history books. But in confusing the issue, delaying consensus, and levering faith to do so, your organization is harming the very families you claim to represent. Perhaps bullying is a policy strategy used by your organization to promote a divisive and judgmental agenda, but a public defense of bullying among young people, which is what you're doing when you downplay the impact of such bullying, is a breathtaking new low. From a secular standpoint, bullying is not good for either party. From a spiritual standpoint, bullying is not good for either party. Mr. Perkins, congratulations on provoking perhaps the single most obvious statement we've ever been moved to make here on State of Belief Radio. Court is adjourned. And a final note, let me state the obvious. At stake in this year's elections is the fate of virtually every issue of social, moral, political significance to religious communities. Civil rights, foreign policy, taxation, issues at the heart of the LGBT community, religious liberty, economic justice, education, poverty, health care, and the future of our nation's children. Now, to be sure, I know that all people of faith and goodwill do not agree on the specifics of how these issues should be addressed by the government. But I also know that all people of faith and goodwill care about these issues and want to see them addressed responsibly and helpfully. The urgency of that interest alone underscores the importance of voting. For me to talk about the importance of voting may strike you as simplistic rhetoric akin to myopic affirmations of motherhood and apple pie. But let me tell you, straight up, that I view talk about the importance of voting as rhetoric about a mandate that pulsates in the heart of our interest in issues of war and peace, balancing national security and fundamental civil rights, and developing a nation that appreciates religious pluralism and refuses to allow diversity to be labeled as a curse instead of a blessing. We have in our midst well-funded voices of division that are both strident and loud. They want democracy only if it is defined by their narrow ideology. Some have even suggested that losing an election should be followed by exercising the freedom of the Constitution to bear arms and foment revolution. Those voices and that influence will not be silenced by criticism or shut down by opposition. It will be countered successfully only when voters, using the power of the ballot box, make it clear that such thought is not acceptable in this nation. Voting is important. In our system of government, the ballot is a great equalizer. Not all of us have direct access to the power of a government platform or to the reach of public media in our nation. But on election day, our votes, your vote, my vote, are as powerful quantitatively and qualitatively as the votes of Bill O'Reilly or Barack Obama. We have no more powerful tool for saying no to politicians with whom we disagree than voting against them. And we have no more effective way of affording service to a politician whom we value than voting for her election to public office. Voting is important. How important is it, the right to vote? Well, it was important enough to make a white, male-dominated government refuse to give women the right to vote until we were over 150 years into this national experience. The right to vote was important enough to cause Medgar Evers to give his life on a road in Mississippi that African Americans might file into polling places on election days and allow their voices to be heard through the ballots that they checked. Listen, friends, politicians don't place the full force of government behind ensuring the denial of a basic right that ought to belong to everybody unless the people in that government fear that a broader exercise of that right could mess up their political playpens. and rob them of positions of power. May I remind you that casting an informed vote is a matter of good government, and it's a matter of good religion. My goodness, the time is already gone this week. That's all the time we have for State of Belief Radio today. But visit us online at stateofbelief.com to find out more about the show. Listen to the show archives and sign up for our podcast. That's stateofbelief.com. I hope you'll tell a friend about our show. We want more listeners, and you'd have more people to talk with about the show and encourage them to sign up too. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. There's not been a time in recent memory where the cause of religious liberty needed more support. So join us today. Become a member. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. Now, we'll be right back here on State of Belief Radio next week with more stories from the intersection of religion and politics. We'll have to take a look at what happened in the elections. I'm going to change the ending of the show today just a bit. Until then, you all take care of this nation as well as you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was. Yes, he was. Thank you.